Hello and welcome to another episode of The Open Floor. I'm Ben Golliver. This week I am joined by Mike Trudell. He's a do everything Lakers reporter for Lakers.com, Spectrum Sportsnet, and ESPN LA Radio. We got together to do a really a deep dive into the pertinent questions facing the Los Angeles Lakers this season. Is LeBron James still the best player in basketball? Can they fashion an elite defense around Anthony Davis? What's up with Frank Vogel in all of this? What should they do at the center position after that DeMarcus Cousins injury? And is there a brewing battle for LA between the Lakers and the Clippers? All that plus some Lego talk. I hope you guys like our conversation. I am so excited to welcome to the Open Floor. I would consider one of the VIP members of the Open Floor Globe. Every once in a while, it'll be late night, and I'm starting getting live texts from Mike Trudell of the Los Angeles sports scene. Mike, I wanted to say you're a big side hustle guy, but I think it's just actually you're a multi-hustle guy. I mean, basically, you've got your hand in everything. Lakers.com writing, sideline reporter and commentator for Spectrum Sportsnet, and then, of course, ESPN LA radio host as well. Mike, thank you so much for welcoming me to your beautiful South Bay mansion. It's great to be here, and thanks for joining the Open Floor for the first time.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here with you, and I am, as you know, a friend of the pod and an Open Glober. I've been listening for years to you,
Sharp. I would consider family member of the pod at this point, because like I said, there's been times where you've just shot off like 50 straight texts, like live tweeting our arguments. You're scoring points like a boxing judge. Did Sharp get
sometimes,
me here?
Sometimes.
Did I get him here? You know what I mean? Like you're an active participant.
Well, my main function is that when you're at games, and typically at Staples Center, I want to make sure that Sharp is aware of what you're trying to do, which is most often go viral.
Yes.
However, it's well-intentioned. You're trying to be the best employee that you can be for your various publications and or podcasts. But I like to try to clip you while you're clipping, for example, Greg Popovich or something. And then I send that to Sharp. And one time I stole your bag also.
Yes.
At Staples Center.
I was going to actually give you credit for being the ambassador to Los Angeles for me. I moved down here, Kobe's last season, and you were very welcoming, helped me get my my bearings here. But since then, you've really taken on these bullying tactics described where you've stolen my beloved suitcase, which I brought with me today. I guess it's a... What is that?
It's like an old man briefcase.
Yeah, it's a briefcase. Yeah. You stole that from me one time at Staples Center, basically giving me a panic attack in public. Not cool at all.
Yeah, I don't know why I did that, honestly. In fact, I think I owe you another apology. But I did, as soon as I saw the level of stress on your face, I quickly returned it to you.
Yeah.
The bag was... 3 feet away from you. So it wasn't like I actually stole it. I just wanted you to feel like it was gone for a moment. That's all.
I bring up the ambassador thing because, in addition to some of this, hazing rituals that you've foisted upon me, you've also really helped me learn about, the Lakers culture, the organization, the people around it. And when I first moved down to LA, I was like, why do people talk about the Lakers? They're terrible. Like, they get way too much coverage. And I think that coming from a place like Portland, where the fan base is rabid, they follow them whether they win or lose, that was sort of kind of my baseline of expectations. And I don't think what I really realized is, first of all, the overall scale of the Lakers fan base, right? And then also just the history involved with how many different winning generations. So I was just kind of curious, when you first moved to LA, taking the job with the Lakers, did you go through a similar like reorientation process where you're just like, all right, now I'm getting into a Lakers bubble that I will never escape from?
Yeah, I came in at a pretty opportune time also. So the first year that I started, I had spent the two prior years with the Minnesota Timberwolves, and this was the 05-06 and 06-07 seasons. All right, let's see. Yeah. 07-08, I should say. And those teams were not very good. It was KG's last year and then Randy Whitman's first full year. And so going into this Lakers team that had been to the finals and lost to Boston, we know, remember that Ariza was hurt, Bynum was hurt. Coming into that season, I thought they had the best roster and I thought they had the best chance to win the title. So I was coming in, really to a ready-made title contending team. And it didn't take me long to realize the difference between the fan base for really the Lakers and honestly every other team around the league. Like, there are a lot of great fan bases. You mentioned Portland is one of them. Some of the teams that, like Utah, where it's the only show in town, I think that does help. OKC's getting there. But the Lakers have been rewarding fans in Los Angeles since 1960 with excellence. Really, before this current stretch, they had missed the playoffs twice under Dr. Jerry Buss since he bought the team in 79. And you just see that generational, not just expectation, but all of the various amounts of joy that the team has brought to the city. And it is kind of the connecting fabric. Because as you've been here now for a few years, there are 17 million people. there are a million things to do. There's the beach, there's Hollywood, there's Orange County, there's downtown, there's Santa Monica, Venice, on and on and on. The Lakers, and I think to a second extent, the Dodgers are that connective tissue. It's the one thing that if you've been here for a little while, that kind of brings everybody together. And that to me has not changed since I first started and the team was great to when they had been struggling for the last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, you've seen it all in the last 10 years, good, bad, and ugly. Obviously, some of those injury ravaged seasons where Kobe's, the whole team's built around Kobe, he goes down and then, what happens? You get the excitement of the LeBron experience starting off, and then that kind of goes sideways. You get the quick rebuild with some of these brilliant young prospects. Everybody's super excited about number two pick Lonzo Ball. The list goes on and on. They have always become a story, and I think I've had to adjust. It's like, all right, well, if you don't have Lakers takes, you're not in the mix. And I think one other thing I want our listeners to know about you, though, is you remember that game, Two Truths and a Lie, where you want to have like the craziest kind of truth that everybody would think that you're lying about?
Is this like Truth or Dare?
It's similar to that, but a party game where you're like, all right, I'm going to tell you three things about me, and one of them's a lie.
Oh, wow.
You would have, to me, an ideal story for Two Truths and a Lie, because I did some background research on you last night. I did some deep digging.
Uh-oh.
And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, you not only challenged Kobe Bryant to a ping pong match, you trash talked him during the ping pong match, you wore a Wu-Tang shirt while you trash talked him during the ping pong match, and you defeated him. Is that a true story? Because you break that at a party, people are going to be like, come on, Mike, stop.
No, it's mostly true. So let's see, it was Thanksgiving of 2013, and thank you for bringing this up, Ben. Thanksgiving 2013, and the team was in Detroit on the road, and I don't think that there was anything scheduled for the team, and so Kobe said, no, let's have a Thanksgiving get-together in the conference room or one of these grand rooms, whatever.
What a depressing place for Thanksgiving, right? Like, when you're seeing the schedule come out, you're just like, Thanksgiving in Detroit. Fantastic.
I like Detroit. I like Michigan. The team stays in a very nice part of Michigan, so that's your slander. I will let the Pistons fans go back at you as an Open Globe floor member. So Kobe makes sure that the team has secured these couple of conference rooms they put together. And in addition to all the food, there was a ping pong table. So naturally, people start playing. And I'd been playing, I think I played Jordan Farmar, and then I don't know if you remember Sean Williams was on the Lakers that year, Sean Williams.
Didn't they have like multiple different Sean Williams at various points, spellings? Yeah. Was this E-A-N?
This was,
or H-A?
Yeah, with the W and E, I think, with the E on the end of it. And I happened to be beating Williams, and so he was getting, not necessarily, I guess a little bit frustrated, and so Kobe was chirping on the sideline. And so I remember, and I was mostly joking, because I didn't think he would play, so I remember doing some amount of trash, like, hey, Kobe, if you want to come get some, you can get some next, or something like that.
Wow.
But it was tongue-in-cheek, and I was laughing, and he said, okay, and he got up, and we played. So we played the first game, and I play a lot of ping-pong. I had a table growing up. It was my game with my dad, so, I'm pretty decent. Kobe had not played a ton, but is Kobe Bryant, is 6'6", and so I handled him, okay in the first match. I beat him pretty handily. And
was he trying to get the psychological warfare on you? Because clearly he probably realized you had the experience advantage early in the match. So how quickly did he try to get into your head?
Well, so he had been watching me, and I think that in his head he probably knew that I was pretty good just by watching. But he also, being Kobe, and rightfully so, must have just assumed that he would beat me just by force of will or force of nature. And this is one of the things, though, that always impressed me about Kobe. From game one to game two, he got better. He was literally studying what I was doing while playing. It was really remarkable to see the look on his face, the focus, the complete calm. So even if he would get mad that I would get a point, it would just register differently than it would to a mere mortal.
Now I'm picturing like Chris Ballard taking notes in the back for like Art of the Beautiful Game, where he's like watching Kobe study the ping pong and like learning all
the
techniques.
It's true, man. It is true. Like, you don't get to be that great at anything unless there's a certain part of your brain that's high functioning like that as a competitor. And so even though I was better by the end of the second game, I had to work a little harder. I'd been kind of praying on his backhand. He made an adjustment, and when you just start to play ping pong randomly with somebody, that's not typically how it goes, right? You just sort of play. And this was not Kobe Bryant. So I think I ended up writing something about it for Lakers.com, and it just was kind of an example of who Kobe Bryant is. Now, admittedly self-serving, since I happened to win the ping pong match, but I think that I had heard after, his security guy told me, and I don't know if this is confirmed because I never asked Kobe, that he told somebody to get him a ping pong table to his house after. Essentially, okay, I'm done losing to people at ping pong.
He's like, 2014 Thanksgiving, when the next year comes around, okay, I'm going to be ready for you.
Yeah, so if I ran into him again, I would say he would be the favorite in this. And side note, best ping pong player I've ever seen in person, Pau Gasol.
Wow.
Crazy, ridiculous. So he, apparently Pau, and I asked him about this, he had gone to ping pong camp at the, like the Spanish national team or something when he was 12. And he was incredible. First of all, he's 7'1". He can reach, of course, any angle on the board. He had not just power, but technique and skill. He had drop shots. It was really, he put on a show. He played a couple of people and then sat down and just like, wow, this guy is something else.
Incredible. So good news, we're not doing the Lakers ping pong podcast. So we just wanted to like give people a slice of the life that you're looking at. What we are going to do here is a deep dive into some of these pressing Lakers questions that are taking place during the offseason. I think right now the one that's on my mind, because I've started top 100 planning, is what do you do with LeBron James? And is there still a case for LeBron as the number one guy? Now, every year at SI that I did the top 100, LeBron was number one. The last couple of years, the debates got a little bit deeper, a little bit, you know, I was really kind of like pressing myself back and forth. Is this guy still on Durant?
Last year, right? You thought about putting Durant
last year, I was very close to making a strong case and just kind of like forcing Rob to go along with me to have Durant at number one.
Especially coming off the
back-to-back finals and just age-wise and LeBron, just is he slipping a little bit? And the more you think about it, the harder it gets to be to make the case against LeBron, because he's just so, you know, still such a singular talent. The things that he can do are still so spectacular that it's very easy to just kind of like mentally envision him being the number one guy in the league. So I guess I'm curious, as somebody who watches every single game these guys play, goes to training camp, travels with these guys, you know, around the world, if you were doing a top 100 or if you were going through this process, would you still have LeBron in the mix for number one? Or would you be more likely to say, all right, some of these other younger guys who are coming up, whether it's Giannis, whether it's Kawhi, Durant's not in the mix, of course, maybe even Harden or Steph Curry, is it their time? Like, is this still his league?
It's a good question. One of the reasons I think that we connect and I like your podcast so much is that you and Sharp are obsessed with the league writ large. And so while I'm with the Lakers day to day, that also means I get to see every team in person twice. And I get to watch a lot of league pass to see the teams that are coming to play them. And so in order to properly analyze this, you really have to watch all of these guys a lot. And if you, last year, the time when LeBron becomes LeBron, we didn't get to see last year, right? He didn't play basically, now he played some after he came back from the injury, but he shut it down in order to preserve the offseason, didn't play in the playoffs. And that's when he literally ramps up round by round.
He came back and said, okay, it's time to flip the switch. And we were all looking around, did he flip it? When's it going to get flipped? And it has not been flipped, and then the season got away from them, right? So what you're saying is we never saw peak LeBron last year.
So take 2 years ago, though, right? So take Cleveland, when we were all watching the regular season, and that team was one of the worst defensive teams in the league. You know, they were basically just outscoring teams, and they'd flipped over half their roster. And then all of a sudden the playoffs start. Oh, yep, there's LeBron again. He's still much better than everybody else. And if you think about the mileage that he's had, he's starting to approach not just like the top 10, but he's starting to approach the top 5 in combined regular season and postseason minutes. So in other words, he's already played more postseason minutes than any player ever, over 10,000. And therefore, on a back-to-back in January, he should not be playing at the same level of defense as a 24-year-old player, right, that hasn't had that kind of mileage. He should be ramping up to the postseason. And so that's one factor where I think we're going to get back to that. But the biggest motivating factor, I think, is that word motivation. Like, he's been sitting here listening to Kevin Durant's the best player in the league now. In the playoffs, Kawhi Leonard is the best player in the league now.
Not to mention David Griffin.
Well, that happened, and all this stuff about Bronny. And I don't think LeBron... really, it's a little bit like Jordan and Kobe. These guys that are that great, I don't know that they really need that extra motivation, because they're going to find it somewhere. They're going to create it. If you don't provide it, they're going to create it. But I think it's clearly there. Plus, he's got his wingman now that he wanted, Anthony Davis. He's got role players around him that he and Anthony Davis had some hand, according to Rob Pelinka, in discussing the type of players they were going to bring in, the Danny Greens and the Quinn Cooks and the Jared Dudleys, the guys that are there to do a specific thing. So all of these things, to me, favor LeBron reclaiming that mantle and saying, hey, everybody, I am still the best player. I know you might not have thought it for whatever reason last year, but here I am, and I expect that bounce back to come from him. And I think that it's, I don't want to say that it's silly not to expect it, but there's so much evidence that LeBron is going to play like this next year, and the case against it is harder to make to me.
Okay, so I'm glad you mentioned the Anthony Davis part, because I think that factors into this discussion too, because the better Anthony Davis plays, like the higher that he finishes on the top 100 type list, don't you think the more credit LeBron's going to get? Like, it's sort of what David Griffin was saying, where like LeBron gets all the credit when things go well, all of his teammates and everybody else takes the blame when things don't go well.
Yeah.
I kind of think that it's really set up for him that way. Like, for example, if Anthony Davis comes out and is in the MVP conversation and, you know, he's near the scoring leader, and, you know, he's got this all-NBA first team type season, he plays 82 games and all that stuff, don't you think it will be very natural for fans, media, maybe even other players to give LeBron a lot of the credit for that as sort of this Anthony Davis savior type person? I guess I'm just wondering, like, even amongst these two players, is it possible for Anthony Davis to kind of eclipse LeBron this year? Or is it going to be one of those situations where LeBron is still in this kind of category by himself, where like the better Anthony Davis plays, the more LeBron gets the credit for it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a mix. So Anthony Davis and LeBron are both going to be great whenever they're on the floor. The degree to which Davis is going to have the ball versus LeBron attacking, I think is going to be determined more by LeBron. And we'll know that maybe, and I think I might have heard you discuss this before in a previous pod, we're going to hear that a bit in the press conferences kind of before and after the preseason games, how much he's going to emphasize Anthony Davis. But I still think that that's all is beside the point, because they're basically going to be running screen roll together and or involved in almost all of the actions. So who finishes the play, who gets the bucket or the assist, I think that's going to even out. It would make sense that Davis would end up leading the team in scoring, and LeBron's assist would go up some, just because LeBron is a better passer. But especially now with the Cousins injury, maybe there are more actions you can involve Anthony Davis in, like he ran for the Pelicans, where he actually last year doubled his assist total from what it usually was. It's usually like around 2, if I recall, and I want to say last year it was more like 4. So yes, it was 2.3 in 17-18, 3.9 in 18-19. And that, to me, was that one element of his game that he hadn't yet gone to, kind of like Kawhi, where they're so elite at scoring and getting their own shot that and so efficient at doing it that you don't make as much out of the passing. But I think that the team is set up that those two guys are the ones that are going to get the bulk of the numbers, just period. Points, rebounds, assists. And then you're going to have some guys like Kuzma chip in with scoring. And Danny Green will hit a couple threes and KCP a couple threes. But I don't think that there will be a lack of production from either. And you can just decide what you like more and who makes more plays in the fourth quarter to figure out who's
up. It becomes a narrative battle, right? So I've had a spy in these Anthony Davis workouts this summer. I'm not going to reveal who it is, but he's been giving me some pretty interesting information. He says that Davis is spending basically all of his time on the perimeter. He's working a lot on his handle. He's working a lot on his sort of off the dribble type moves. So that could be in pick and roll situations. It could also just be like turn and face situations. He's been working on his outside shot a little bit. He's been working on going downhill. I mean, that's a situation where the passing skills you're describing, which I love to see from superstar level players when they really like, you know, use that as a major element to add to their game. I would love to see, you know, him being the guy who kind of initiates drive and kick stuff too, because you're going to have a lot of these guys, whether it's Danny Green or whoever else, spot shooters, Kyle Kuzma, where if LeBron isn't the only one who has to create their shots, the offense will work a lot better. So
yeah, that's a good point.
When I'm looking at these guys, I still think LeBron is going to be number one in terms of perception next year, in terms of top 100 type rating next year on this team. Now, whether he's going to be number one overall in the league, I do have my doubts. I think the defensive consistency is a concern, and I think you're sort of raising this is why he wouldn't go crazy during the regular season. If you're imagining him in next year's playoffs, do you feel like he still has something close to the defensive ceiling he had in the last couple finals? Because I thought against Golden State in the last two finals against KD, his offensive ceiling was where it had always been, and arguably the best offensive basketball he's ever played, because he was so intelligent, had such great feel and everything else. I really felt though, like defensively, he wasn't at that A-plus level. And in a lot of cases, he wasn't taking on the Durant assignment. And so I'm just worried that, like, if he's not that same player on that end, we probably have to dock him in the overall number one player conversation.
Well, so this is why MVP, specifically, and if you want to extend that to all NBA first team, that kind of regular season stuff ends up having more import And especially, look, like, why did Giannis get the MVP last year? Well, every night you're getting the same type of a package. But to me, I like to think about the macro reason for the regular season, which is still to get the highest seed for the playoffs.
Right.
That's really the only thing the regular season is for. And think about Kobe Bryant. When we weren't talking about efficiency as much 10 years ago, he was using the regular season to work on some of the shots that he knew he was going to get in the playoffs when the defense tightened up. And as such, his career field goal percentage is a bit lower. But he ended up using those shots in the moments that counted. And so now, defensively, I think it's part of the same thing. If it doesn't really make sense, and I guess if you're 22 and you have it, it doesn't make sense to have this total defensive mindset only when you also have to carry the team's offense. And this is part of the reason for criticism for James Harden, for example,
right.
For Steph Curry to a different degree, LeBron, the guys that have had to carry that degree of the load offensively, it is difficult to have the legs to do it defensively as well.
So that's where Giannis gets some credit. Yeah, so let me just like punt the regular season stuff. Let me take your argument and say, hey, you know what? We know how he's going to manage a season. Do you think he still has that defensive ceiling available to him in the postseason, right? Like, let's say it's Clippers, Lakers, Western Conference Finals, and you know it's the highest level of basketball. We know how the show operates out here in the West Coast, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not AAA.
Right.
So it's a de facto finals. LeBron's out there. Can he still crank it up defensively to an A level throughout a series if he has to play 40 minutes a night, or is he in a different place of his career? That's what I worry about.
Yeah, so we don't have to dismiss your initial point, which is a good one, which is about, like, can somebody do it on a regular season given night? What I saw last year from LeBron in person was, especially when, you know, the Lakers were what? They were the 4 seed on Christmas when he got hurt. He would ramp up the defense in the last 6 minutes, especially of the fourth quarter. All of a sudden, boom, there's LeBron at the rim for help side defense. He's doubling down on a big that's getting a catch on the block. He's making a couple of winning plays, basically, and asserting himself. Like, the most famous example of this, of course, is the Iguodala chase down block. But I think those are the plays that you start to see ramp up. Literally every month, maybe you get a couple more of those. So there's a couple in October, then you add a few in November, December. By the time they're really getting into the playoff standings, that's when you're seeing more and more and more of those games, especially if you, quote unquote, need to win a game to put yourself in better playoff seating. So I do think that there's plenty of that left in LeBron. And then that's part of what Anthony Davis is for, though, in those November and December and January games as a 26-year-old, to really carry that mantle defensively. And that's what Danny Green is for. That's what Kyle Kuzma should be expected to ramp up his defense, which I've been pretty impressed with what he's been doing with Team USA. And I think that Popovich and Kerr, like, that's a nice little system to get into and a mindset. So to get to the end of your actual question,
yeah.
In the postseason, does it make a difference then? Can they do it then? I think so, but it certainly needs to be shown, and they haven't had a chance to show it because it's a brand new team.
Yeah, no, I think Kyle Kuzma couldn't have had better summer school teachers, right? Like, if you're a Lakers fan and you're tired of, you know, seeing some of his lapses in awareness, or you know, some of the times when people blowing by him on the perimeter or whatever it might be, or getting kind of muscled around the basket, sending him to 6 or 8 weeks of Greg Popovich and Steve Kerr finishing school, I think is the right way to do it. I'm still skeptical there on what his defensive ceiling is as a player, but this sort of leads me to my next question, which is, if we are to take the Lakers seriously as an A-list contender, they have to be a top 10 defense, right? And is there a way for them to become a top 10 defense that isn't relying upon Anthony Davis to basically be like a defensive player of the year guy? Like, doesn't he have to carry that level low with this group?
I do think that Vogel can help some there. He certainly has some chops in the past, and I'm curious to see how he puts his defensive scheme into play, how Davis is featured in it. But if you're – so I did this kind of experiment thinking about the Western Conference, basically, and I know how you feel about the East. I don't feel quite as poorly about it.
You don't have to be nice to the fans. Come on. You can keep it real.
Well, I mean, Philly and Milwaukee could win the title next year.
Yeah, there's two good teams in the Eastern Conference. As we do this every single year. We have to pretend that the other ones are actually –
I would say Boston is good, not great. I don't think they can win the title.
All right.
And I actually don't love Indiana as much. So there are a couple teams like that where I've always – really liked Utah, and now I think that the buzz is almost a little bit high on Utah because of their wings. I think we share this theory that seems pretty obvious, that big wings make a big difference in the postseason. And if you've got Lillard and McCollum or Conley and Mitchell as your best players, you know, that can be tricky when you can have a big rotate over. So that gets back to the Lakers and thinking about defensively. So if a lot of this does hinge on the fact that what are we going to get defensively from LeBron, or what is the league going to get defensively from LeBron? I'm not willing to bet against him in those big moments on that end. Danny Green is probably the best 3-and-D guy that they could have gotten. I agree that Kuzma has to show it this season, that he's made some advances defensively, but his second year was much better than his first year on that end of the floor, and we know that he cares. So then who else are you going to get that's a big contributor on that end? How can JaVale McGee be a bit more consistent throughout the season? He was good early. He was good late. He had that stretch that was with the pneumonia in the middle of the season.
I don't want to be a jerk. I feel like the ship has kind of sailed on him, or at least we know what he's about, you know?
Well, he's good at protecting the rim from the weak side, and that's one thing that he does. But in crunch time lineups, which is, I guess, how we should probably think most about this from a defensive perspective, you're going to have Anthony Davis, LeBron James, Danny Green, probably Kuzma, and then if you're looking for defense, we'll see what Avery Bradley, how he looks, or Alex Caruso. And that could be a pretty good defensive lineup, right? You're versatile, you can switch, you've got rim protection, you've got some decent foot speed on the perimeter. So if the rest of the Western Conference defensively, like Utah is going to be pretty solid. The Spurs, but I don't see them as being a real contender. I see them kind of the bottom end of the conference. Houston defensively, you're going to have Westbrook and Harden on the perimeter. You know, that's basically a weakness, right? And then you've got Eric Gordon and Tucker, who are pretty good on that end. But you know, so I don't know if there's a dominant defensive team except on the wings, the Clippers, with George and Leonard. But then who's their fifth guy going to be?
Well, here's one thing I would say. We've spent a lot of time focusing on, like, the Warriors, like the fall of the super team. So Kevin Durant is out of there. So now it's like this leveling effect. And usually when we talk about that, we think about the offensive end. But I think what you're really, you know, driving home here very clearly is that the same thing is happening on the defensive end. Because the Warriors, when they were fully locked and loaded with all their guys, including Iguodala, Livingston, all those guys, were an obscenely good defensive team.
Yes, right.
And now they are not. I mean, Kevin Durant is definitely, you know, a big hit for them. Iguodala, even if he was back, kind of aging, you know, over the course of regular season, he's a hit for them.
Yeah, Clay not back until
there is a hit for them. And so they're really going to be trying to kind of scramble to put the pieces together on that end, especially because they have to play D'Angelo tons of minutes, and you're just not going to get tons from him on that end, I don't think. So,
look at who else. I mean, Denver, right? So there, Jokic is going to be on the floor. Improved last year, but that doesn't scare you defensively. I do like Jeremy Grant as an addition. But Portland, not a defensive monster that you're going to worry about for a crunch time five. You know, there isn't – that's my point, is that I get it that there are some holes that the Lakers are going to have to prove, but I don't think there's another lineup that really scares you that much defensively when you can go down the other end and then you got LeBron and Anthony Davis to score.
For sure. So I guess I come back to their formula to be a top 10 defense. It relies very, very heavily on Anthony Davis to me. I think that this question about is he going to play 4 or 5, I really hope that he gets – a lot of late game minutes at the five. You know, I understand he came out and said, I don't really want to be doing that a ton during the regular season. And Rob was saying all the right things, Rob Pelinka, their general manager, about, hey, we want to protect him. This is a long-term asset and all of that. But look, I listened to LaMarcus Aldridge say the exact same thing in the exact same tone for years and years and years. And like, man, your team would be better if you played center in important moments. You should just kind of bite the bullet and do it. I think, you know, defensively, some of the guys that I worry about, Avery Bradley in tough season last year. I mean, he's a guy who we kept on the top 100 for years and years, probably after he deserved it. If he bounces back, that's a major X factor. If he's just done, that's going to be a tricky one for them. I do like Caruso, who you mentioned. Quinn Cook and Troy Daniels, kind of those end of the rotation guys. I mean, they're giving you really basically nothing on the defensive end. I guess long story short, I think if I were them and looking to make some of these additional roster moves, you know, as the season unfolds, I would still be looking for at least one more backcourt defensive piece if I could find one. And then, of course, they have this question at center too, which I'm not sure they're going to be able to, you know, really address their center depth in, you know, an impact-making type of way, you know, after the Cousins injury. But I guess that my challenge, if I was Frank Vogel, and this is sort of my big takeaway point, is I'm coming into training camp knowing that I'm basically already on the hot seat. I mean, it's a weird situation. It's a lot of tension. I think he probably understands the deal. And I would just kind of come out, you know, chest puffed out and say, Anthony Davis, man, this is on you. I want you to be the defensive player of the year. I want you to lead this group as much as you possibly can. We're going with you, and hope that that works.
Yeah, I mean, betting – so betting on, if you have to bet on Anthony Davis and LeBron, you're in a good place. That's who, the kind of guys that you should want to bet on. So every team that's got a chance to win the West is going to have to rely on their stars, obviously, right? So in this case, can Anthony Davis raise his game a level alongside LeBron? Sure. Like, who's the best player that Davis has ever played with? You know, healthy Cousins, Drew Holiday?
Drew Holiday, probably.
Yeah, so LeBron is considerably better than anybody, right, that he would have played with. So that, to me, in its own right, allows him to go up a level. It allows him to do more defensively. It allows him to have more open looks on offense. So I do expect that he's going to gain a level, but I think the whole discussion just we're having generally about the Western Conference and playing center. So when you're playing late game center, it's not really center. Almost all teams are going small now. There's no banging. There's not really many post-ups. It's more or less a switching, screen roll, you know, spread the floor, pick and pop to some extent, even more than pick and roll. Like that, those minutes at center are different from the opening six of the half when you might be banging against your Jokic's or your Nurkic's when he comes back healthy. Or
yeah, the rotation clogger guys, you know, the people who are just the big bodies like the Zubox of the world who are just buying
Whiteside, and you know, Embiid is kind of the exception of a guy that's going to be in there in crunch time. But even then, he's not posting a ton, and you can do a quick double, right? So I do. That's why I expect this whole thing about Davis and whether or not he's playing center, I don't see as a big issue. I think you start a big next to him in the first quarter and the third quarter, and then more often than not, when everybody's going small, that's when he's your major advantage. Like, who are the Clippers putting on him? Montrezl Harrell or Zubats? That's going to be tough. They may have to try to put Kawhi on him, and then you're almost wasting Kawhi because Davis can still get a clean look even against Kawhi for the most part. So that, to me, remains, in addition, of course, to LeBron. Like, when we're really trying to suss out who's going to win a series in the West and what's going to happen in crunch time and trying to remember the devastating player that LeBron is in a playoff series, that's, to me, where they have to get to. And that's where I think they can feel confident in what they have. But, of course, there's a lot of time in the regular season to prove that cohesion and to figure out rotations, and that's where Frank Vogel is going to come into play.
Okay, so gun to your head right now, I mean, how optimistic are you feeling about this group? I'm sensing some pretty good optimism. I think clearly their offensive ceiling should be really, really high. I mean, they've got the right kind of the pieces fit. The superstars should gel. You're talking about the high screen and roll. I mean, it's going to be a highlight parade. You know, that's just what I'm assuming, right? It's going to be a dunk every single night. I think people saw LeBron, playing around on 2K, throwing alley-oops to Anthony Davis. Like, we should be seeing that, you know, basically every single night. Defensively, I have more questions. I think that they've got, you know, a few pieces to get it, you know, started in the right direction. And they're going to have, you know, some other guys who need to step up and prove it. But if you were trying to place them, whether it's within the conference standings or a win total or even, you know, like a push into the playoffs, how far do you think this team can go?
I mean, so they're the team right now in the NBA that has two of the top 10 players. We can debate where we think Paul George healthy sits. And, you know, part of the reason you have to even ask about the Clippers is he going to be back right away? Is it going to be 6 weeks? That can be the difference between a one seed and a four seed or a two seed and a six seed in the West. And so it ultimately does come down, I think, with a lot of these teams close, whether it's the Clippers, the Lakers, the Rockets, the Jazz, the Warriors when Klay gets back. The Nuggets, to me, are better than a lot of people still realize. It's going to come down to who can stay the healthiest. And if the Lakers are healthy, I would have a hard time betting against LeBron and Davis with good role players around them. And especially given they do have one open roster spot. We'll see what they do in the coming days. So by the time this posts, who knows? We'll see what they do with the center position. And then do they add a playmaker at some point later in the season around the break with that 15th spot? So there's still stuff that can happen. But ultimately, I think you do look at the biggest factor if you're in any one of those teams. And I'm having a hard time betting against LeBron and Davis. And I don't think that's a controversial take or one that is made because we're living here in Los Angeles. That to me is still the best way to win in the NBA.
So you're saying title.
Well, they're Hooray. Certainly a title contender, right? So the Vegas odds are what they got. Clippers, Lakers, Bucks, Rockets, Sixers okay. are the top five. All those teams can win the title. The Lakers are certainly among them. And it's going to probably depend on a bunch of factors, but health probably being the biggest one.
Is Vogel the guy for this? I mean, are you sold? Because that was one of the weird things about this, the way this summer played out was like this long-ranging pursuit of Anthony Davis had so many twists and turns, but it wound up in exactly the place that they wanted, right? So they could almost spin it as like, hey, you know, it didn't happen when we wanted in February, but like, you know, Rich Paul is the kingmaker. Here he did it. He got his guy where he wanted to be. Now he's going to be this, like, you know, gigantic superstar for the next 5 years. And same deal with Pelinka. He can say, you know, all this, you know, magic stuff, whatever, that happened. But at the end of the day, judge us by our results. We got Anthony Davis. That's like the biggest move of the entire summer. You know, if you want to debate that or Kawhi, that's fine.
Yeah.
But in the middle of that was this weird coaching search where it kind of goes sideways. They interview multiple candidates. You know, Ty Lue's got the birthday cake. They settle on Frank Vogel. Everybody's looking around like, why'd they take Frank and bring in Jason Kidd as an assistant coach? I think that even more than some of the question marks on the court, that dynamic is definitely going to hang over this team early in the season, don't you think?
I haven't sensed that around the building. I mean, Frank Vogel, when he took the job, was well aware, right, that Jason Kidd was going to be a key part of his coaching staff. Then they brought in Lionel Hollins, who is another really strong voice, and Phil Handy. You know, Ben, certainly I think a lot of people that follow the league really closely know that Phil is one of the best development guys that has now turned into a full-fledged assistant coach. Got a really good relationship with LeBron James. All four of those guys can challenge stars, I think, and have before. And so I think Vogel, I've actually been really impressed in the short time that he's been here with how he's answered questions about what he wants to do with the team.
So how would you describe his personality or just like his approach? Because look, like I think from the outside, like even seeing him in summer league where he's like shaking LeBron James's hand and Anthony Davis's hand, he's like got this very polite style to him, you know, where it's like, it's not like he doesn't want to interrupt their day or something, you know, it's not like this big swaggering, like, oh yeah, I'm Jason Kidd or I'm Mark Jackson or I'm one of these kinds of coaches. Like, how would you describe kind of his personal style?
Yeah. I mean, so part of that probably comes, this is just my own thinking about this as you just asked the question. So some of the coaches that were former players in the NBA generally, right, carry themselves a certain way. And then the coaches that kind of work their way up as coaches, the Brad Stevens and Eric Spoelstra, you know, like Vogel to an extent, carry themselves another way, as in like, here, this is my expertise in the coaching side. I want to do this with you. Like, I want to have a team with you. It's not just my way or the highway. Let's talk about it. Here are my theories. This is why the defense is going to work. And I think he had success with that in Indiana. Orlando was strange. It was a young roster. Then they had the GM change, right? But I think that Vogel at least understands the best way to put a team on the court. He's evolved his thinking with three-point shooting and analytics and how to switch and when on defense, all that kind of stuff. So I think that it works just fine. Like, I don't think there's any, I don't see a big issue there. They seem to be, so far, everything seems to be pretty much on the same page, Ben. But we literally haven't even had a day of training camp practice yet. So
I want you to predict the whole season and tell me how it's going to go. Yeah. No, it's funny. I can picture this alternate universe where Frank Vogel is like banging out like YouTube videos where he's breaking down defensive sets. Like if he never gets his huge coaching break, right, he's probably doing like a dorky podcast like this. I mean, he has that kind of a vibe to him.
Yeah, he seems like a really nice guy, but I think that he doesn't seem too nice where he's not willing to get into it and engage with players. But yeah, it is. I have noticed that there is a difference from some of those swaggering guys that play in the league and we're going to do it this way, and then some of the guys that worked out of the film room like Vogel did that view it as somewhat of a partnership with the players.
Nothing but love for the film room guys. And we shouldn't forget, he did coach a pretty big star in Indiana with Paul George. I mean, Paul George was, you know, a fairly legit star. They went to the Eastern Conference Finals multiple times. He wasn't on the same level, I think, in terms of his perception as he is today. But in Indiana, like that was like the biggest star and the kind of foundational guy that they had. Basically since Reggie Miller, I would say.
And I mean, I think he got LeBron's respect in those playoff series. They had some really good battles when LeBron was with the Heatles. And Vogel, to me, the one thing, yes, he's a nice guy, but he's also a fiery competitor, right? So that is the thing that you have to become an NBA coach, I think. There's no kind of just Mr. Nice Guy there because he smiles and he's nice at the press conference. So I do think that there's a serious competitive side there.
Hey guys, some people think that all diet and weight loss plans are the same. But that's because they haven't tried Noom. Noom is a new, totally different approach to losing weight and getting healthy that uses psychology and small goals to help you change your habits, making it easy to lose the weight and keep it off for good. Noom combines the power of technology with real human support, offering as little or as much help as you want along the way. And since Noom is an app, it's always with you and easy to use, which makes it super easy to stay on track and reach your goals. It's just as simple to get started. go online, answer a few quick questions, and they'll create a personalized program just for you. Noom can help you lose your old way of thinking about food and dieting. So what do you have to lose? Visit Noom.com/podcast, Noom.com/podcast, and start your 14-day trial today. Change your habits, change your mind, change for good with Noom. Noom.com/podcast, Noom.com/podcast. So let's talk about this center position, because I think reported today on Tuesday, Adrian Wojnarowski of ESPN said Dwight Howard, I think Marcin Gortat. Were there some other names that they were working out?
I think on that report there, I think Joakim Noah.
Basically the usual suspects are the guys who are now, you know, potentially going to step in now that DeMarcus Cousins, was announced to have an ACL. We expect him to miss all of next season. His third major leg injury in 19 months. I mean, there's a very real chance DeMarcus Cousins doesn't play another NBA game. I mean, I don't think we should rule that out. I don't want to write him off. I certainly think he's going to attack his rehab and do whatever he can to continue his career. But it's a different thing to get healthy than it is to stay healthy. And I think that second part has really been what's tripped him up here, you know, over the last year. But of the names that have floated, whether it's Dwight Howard, Joakim Noah, Marcin Gortat, does one of those pop to you as like a good idea? And then I guess in general with the Dwight experience, you were here the first time around. Is there something that outsiders either got wrong or misinterpreted about his time here? Or is the perception of kind of, you know, it blowing up in everyone's face kind of accurate?
So what to do about this position, and of course everybody feeling really badly just for DeMarcus Cousins, has been the major topic for the last week here. We talked about it on Spectrum, we talked about it on ESPN Radio, and my summary thought is, so take out whoever the replacement player that comes in at that center position. I do think it's going to be a center, because I think you want another big body to put next to Anthony Davis at certain times in the lineup. And right now, it's just JaVale McGee, really.
They really do need another, like, 7-footer, just, like, even, I mean, not Tyson Chandler, but, like, that kind of type of player.
Yeah, so yeah. I think that would be the type of player, based on what we've heard about, you know, how Davis likes to play. But that aside, I still think that this, more than anybody else, impacts Kuzma and even Jared Dudley. Because you're not going to find a player that can do the things exactly that Cousins could do, which is create offense on himself. Cousins a much better passer than people realize from the high post. Cousins shot the three pretty well in New Orleans next to Davis. I think he was around 37%, which is more than fine, right, for that position. And the volume was high too. He's willing to take them, which essentially would have meant that you have that space for either Davis or LeBron to get to the rim. It's the people know. I don't need to tell people on your podcast.
These are experts here. He could be a stretch five, right? And like, I think that going along with that, we saw in Golden State a willingness to scale his role or his touches. I mean, not feeling like he had to be a number one or even a number two guy. Yeah. And that was going to be the same deal for the Lakers. It's one reason why I kind of liked the move for the Lakers, because their pitch of what they wanted from Cousins was going to be pretty similar to what the Warriors wanted from Cousins too. A big part of that would just be to fill minutes as a starting center, potentially. So what you're arguing, though, is that some of these other players, whether it's Kuzma or Dudley, can maybe pick up some of the slack from Cousins?
Well, yeah, because I think that you're still – so functionally, right? So Cousins can take up a lot of space and is really good around the glass and et cetera, but he's not necessarily the best defender on that end anyway. And so it seems to me that it would make more sense to go small – more often and let Dudley can bang with a couple of centers. He did it last year in Brooklyn. LeBron can guard a center here and there. Kuzma can as well. Now that's something that that still needs to develop. I know, Ben, you wrote about at Team USA some of the younger players. Who are you talking about? Bagley, for example, the longer players Kuz had a little problem with down there.
Yeah, so Kuzma, like, he gets in trouble when he's in the basket area and he's going against like lots of wingspan, right? So it's like Jaren Jackson Jr.,
yeah,
Marvin Bagley, Jared Allen. It was honestly like a murderer's row of like Kuzma killers on the select team, just randomly all assembled in that one place. And they wound up like none of them got promoted besides Bagley, and then he just left. So it really didn't come through. And when you look at some of these international rosters, I don't know how much he's going to be tested on that front, right? Like, as long as he's playing four, I'm not sure if there's going to be a lot of super long fours that he's really going to have to deal with around the basket in FIBA. So it may have been a situation where like his biggest weakness was showing through in a setting like at the FIBA World Cup camp, where like on a game-to-game basis, it wouldn't be so glaring.
Yeah, but at the same time, so you mentioned on that end, the whole key, and this is obvious, again, Open Floor Globers know this quite well, what happens on the other end then? So if that player has to guard Kuzma, who's spacing out from three, can take somebody off the dribble, and it's Davis and it's LeBron also on the perimeter who can get to the rim, unless you're going to try to put a shot blocker in there, that you can get him back on that side. So in other words, people have seen this happen more and more in the NBA.
You're basically trading twos for threes, right?
To some extent, or you're not so worried. Hey, if you guys want to go, if you want to go to post ups, fine. Okay, you can post up. If you want to try to post up Kuz, if you want to try to post up Dudley, we can double. And then if you miss, it's a bucket on the other end. And so that type of gameplay to me stands out, especially with Dudley, who's a smart vet and kind of can figure out how to manipulate those situations, than necessarily you're going to be able to find right away on the waiver wire. But also, the season has to be viewed as fluid as well. And this is something where Plink has shown a willingness to make moves in the middle of the season. Who knows if some team ends up having an excess of a certain position. Center, to me, Ben, is the spot where you can find the most guys that are out there because they've been just utilized less. A lot of teams don't want to have more than one or two. So I don't know. It's something that I think it will certainly be addressed, but I think that the guys that are going to see more of the minutes in the long run of the season are the Kuzmas for the most part, and then you know maybe it's Dudley, maybe it's even KCP, and you slide Green up to the three, that kind of thing.
Okay, quick question on Kuzma before we get back to Dwight Howard. Last year he was 30% three-point shooter. As a rookie, he was basically a 37% three-point shooter both years on pretty high volume for his player. Where's the truth there, or was there anything that you saw last year that caused or influenced his dip in his three-point percentage, and how good of a three-point shooter can he be? Because if he's back to being a 37% three-point shooter with LeBron and Anthony Davis, I mean, now you're really on to something from an offensive standpoint, right?
Yeah, so Kuz, to me, is I don't even want to say somewhere in the middle. I think he's more like he was as a rookie than he was last year from three, and a couple of different factors came into play. So especially once the injury started happening and Lonzo and Ingram were essentially hurt throughout the season, Kuz became the second scorer, and he was taking some difficult shots. And he would admit that some of these were his own poor shot selection, which was something they kind of worked on throughout the season. And some of it was seemingly by necessity, where that he was the guy that they looked to when it wasn't going to be LeBron that got the shot at the end of the clock. Because his volume, his rookie year from three, was 5.6 per game, which is a pretty good sample size. Like, that's, you know, that's a lot of threes, and he shot 37%. And I think that it gets back to that this season. So somewhere in that range, there's nothing wrong with his shot. He doesn't have a hitch, right? He certainly doesn't lack for confidence. But I did think that as the season went on last year and it sort of snowballed the way that he was shooting and he kept taking tough shots. So I would give him the benefit of the doubt, but there's no question he's got to show it and he's got to prove it early in the season, because now every game looking at the Western Conference is going to matter. And so I think that pressure is going to be on all these guys now that it's both LeBron and Anthony Davis, and they feel like they can win the title and not just, you know, possibly be a problem. And we'll see getting LeBron to the playoffs last year.
For sure. I mean, he's like their X factor, I think, this year. In college, he was around a 30% shooter. Again, there were some fluctuations kind of from year to year. You know, the volume wasn't huge in college, so that's why it was so exciting, I think, in his rookie year, where he comes out hitting, you know, he's just, you know, looking like your very, you know, typical stretch for exactly what you would want. He should have easier looks this year, basically no question about it. It'll be great to see, like, what can he do with that opportunity. Now, this talk about him as a third star, okay, that's too much for me. Okay, let's pump the brakes on that. Let's, you know, settle for, you know, high quality, well-fitting stretch four.
How about star in his role?
Okay, yeah.
You know, that to me is what he should be. Like, the same thing that he's trying to do for Team USA. He's most likely going to come off the bench, just given that it's LeBron and Anthony Davis at the 3-4, that you're not going to get a better 3-4 than that. So that sort of, there's a bit of a, you can hope that he develops into that Lamar Odom kind of spot, where, you know, Lamar probably a bit better of a playmaker, great with a handle, kind of a young point guard. But Kuz has some of that in him, that versatile skill set. And Lamar also probably a better defender overall. But, you know, again, Kuz still young, and you mentioned as the X factor, he is the guy that can get better, more so than anybody else. You know, maybe I think Davis still has another rung to jump to.
Yeah, I'll say this: if Davis's 2020 season isn't the best year of his career, I will be so disappointed, because I think it's setting up really well for him. I think that, you know, having the LeBron factor is going to be great for him. I think that he's wanted the platform a little bit too, and he's right in his age prime, right? Like, this is the time to do it. So I would hope that
he played limited minutes last year.
Yeah, right? he's rested.
Like, he and LeBron, like, that's the other, really. So compared to George and Leonard, and who both had injuries that they dealt with last year, George coming off surgery, LeBron and Anthony Davis didn't play in the playoffs, played limited minutes, right? Like, that's an advantage in the mileage game, which it makes some difference, right?
Yeah, we're going to come back to the Clippers stuff, because I think you're one of the greatest Clippers nitpickers there is on the earth. But real quick with Dwight, I mean...
That is false and unfair.
we'll debate it. On Dwight, is it worth a shot? And what do you remember from the first go-around?
So the first go-around was just... There was just a lot going on. And I think one of the things that I... pointed to, I don't know if you remember this, so the NBA, and I want to say it was inside the NBA, but they do it on NBA TV, they do kind of a round table before the season, and Shaq made a comment that Dwight was just a screen roll center, right, just before that Lakers season with Nash, and so Dwight, I think, heard that and wanted to show that he was a post-up player, and so that ended up being an issue with D'Antoni.
Yeah, he had real, like, kind of basketball father issues with Shaq, didn't he? I mean, it was real deep-seated stuff.
Yeah, it was some stuff like that, I think. So I do think that permeated, though, in the season. And then, you know, we know at this point how that went with Kobe and with Nash. And it just, the whole season just didn't work out. And then eventually, you know, they make the move and he makes the decision to go elsewhere. And so it didn't end well or go well there. But Dwight's been on a lot of teams since then. So I don't think it's necessarily, I don't think you have to look at him or any player from their former, like, being with the Lakers 6-7 years ago.
Right.
I think you look at how that player played last year. And I think Dwight played 9 games last year. The injuries that they have, what they could potentially do in a certain role. So you evaluate him like you do everybody else.
So, yeah, that's a good point, because there's basically nobody from that team around, right? So, like, the Lakers thing isn't actually that relevant. I mean, the only people who are still there are what? Jeannie Buss?
Basically, those of us on the broadcast side, okay. I think, and a lot of the people within the actual Lakers office. But you're right, from a even training staff and the coaching staff, the development staff, the analytics guys, the film, all of that is new, right? So there really isn't anybody left in the building from there.
Right, so there's no skeletons in the closet because they've all been removed and there's new people, basically, is what we're saying for Dwight. So your point on let's judge him about the more recent history, I think, is the right way to do this, rather than just saying, okay, it failed in 2013, so we shouldn't try it again, right? Last year, I mean, you basically have to write off. He was injured the whole way. He, in Las Vegas, he was saying all the right things, and he was in very good shape. So we have that as, you know, a sort of a starting point for this conversation. You have to give him credit there. But when I look at Dwight, and I think about what do the Lakers want to be, what kind of a team are they hoping to be, I mean, it's all about the playoffs, right? Dwight has been on a team that's advanced in the playoffs once since 2010. And it was a Houston team that was basically carried by James Harden, right? He's been on some pretty talented teams along the way there. And he's been in situations where, even in Atlanta, where they started to really cut his minutes once they got to the postseason. I think the fact that Dwight says all the right things during the offseason because he wants to, you know, continue to have his career and to see how far he can take it, it's a good thing. But it's not exactly controversial to say I don't necessarily trust him, that once he gets into the situations, is he going to stick to game plans? Is he going to be comfortable with, you know, basically no touches on offense? Because to me, at this point, he's basically a fifth option on offense, right? And I'm not sure that he is totally aware of that or has totally internalized that. And then I think defensively, I mean, it comes down to the health, but the impact there, at least besides that, the Charlotte season, where he did have one nice season in Charlotte, just hasn't been there either. And I just think that there's some, you know, even putting aside the Lakers baggage from the previous tenure, which I think is the right thing to do, I just have concerns personality-wise, focus-wise. There's a lot, you know, I've already raised this kind of questions about some of the things that Vogel's dealing with. Like, if I was Vogel, I just wouldn't even want to deal with it. I wouldn't want to bring Dwight Howard in. I just think that the risks maybe outweigh the rewards. And if there's somebody like Joakim Noah who does some of the same things that you're trying to get from Dwight, or, you know, even Gortat, I mean, to me, those would be preferable options.
Yeah, so I just think this spot, and really any spot on the roster, and Pelinka showed this throughout the summer, any spot on the roster has to complement LeBron and Anthony Davis. And how those two are going to have the ball the most, things are going to run through them. And what player can excel in a role next to those guys. And in the case of needing a center, right, you either need to have a space five, or you have to have, you know, somebody that can kind of take the banging defensively and just be really good at that and good in the locker room. And so whichever guy that they're looking at that can do those things the best, they're going to sign. And I don't know who it is. I don't know which player. There might be some guys they're looking at that we don't even know about. Who knows? So there's probably a lot going on there, Ben. And ultimately, I'll pivot back to that same point I made before. I just think that Cousins going out, you're going to lean more heavily on the guys that are definitely going to be in the rotation for big minutes. It's the Kuzmas. Maybe that means KCP plays more. Those are the guys that are going to have the bulk of this responsibility. It's not necessarily going to be whoever they bring in as this last roster spot.
For sure. No, I hear you on that. I just think for me on the priority list, Dwight would probably not even be on the list. And we'll see. You know, it'll be really interesting after they do this little group workout of, you know, who do they settle on or who do they land on with that decision? Because I think it will tell us a little bit about what are their priorities or what are they kind of hoping to do with that spot. But you're right. I mean, we should probably not be overplaying the gigantic hole at center because, ultimately it's going to be Davis in the moments that count. And McGee is going to be able to give you, starter level minutes like he did last season. All right, let's wrap this up. We're here in LA, beautiful Los Angeles. It's kind of become the center of basketball. And all everybody wants to talk about is battle for LA, battle for LA. You've got opening week, Clippers-Lakers. You've got Christmas, Clippers-Lakers. We've already seen the billboards going up everywhere with Kawhi Leonard and Paul George. I think Kawhi Leonard bought a million backpacks today, apparently, for students, which... That is, again, it's a major statement. I think the Clippers are really trying to make lots of statements. So I'm curious, you've been here for 10 years. Is this clearly peak Clippers? I mean, is this their best moment? And then how do you think an organization that's sort of, been maybe in the Lakers' shadow for a long time, like what kind of a challenge is it for them almost going into like a favorite role, right? Because I think they are like the Vegas favorites or right near the top of that list. And it's something that they've really never dealt with before.
Yeah, I think so. Basketball-wise, the Clippers have done a great job. The organization has done a really good job. They've built up the front office. They've made some good draft picks. Clearly, they made this free agency splash. So that, to me, shouldn't be questioned. And I think it's absolutely going to be a battle on the court. But in the same way that it is for the Lakers and the Warriors and the Rockets and some of these teams that are still at the top of the Western Conference. So The whole LA thing, I've just, my own experience, and it's colored in purple and gold glasses because that's where I've spent most of my time, but just seeing how the city is, it is a Laker town. It just is. And that part of it is so embedded and so deep that I'm not sure I see that changing no matter how sort of the on-court basketball stuff goes, because it didn't change when the Lakers were in their most down years ever, and the Clippers had the Lob City run. Even though they didn't get past the second round, they had Chris Paul, Blake Griffin, DeAndre, and Redick, and they were really good. Like, they were a much better team. I don't think that changed the landscape in Los Angeles, and I'm not sure that necessarily ever happens, but from a basketball perspective, I do think the Clippers have come a long way, even from then, and have to be reckoned with, not just now, but in the future. But I don't buy in quite as much to the battle for sort of the fans in Los Angeles. I think that battle has sort of been long won. It's a bit Yankees-Mets or, Cubs-White Sox. It's a bit embedded like that. But I do think that the basketball side very much should be respected.
Yeah, it's really interesting because when you look at the way the Clippers message things, it's not that they're saying we want to like take LA. Like their slogan is LA our way, right? It's like they're trying to create their own lane and they're very much focused on keeping it about the games on the court, like the blacktop style where it's like Patrick Beverley and, these guys like Kawhi and Paul George, where it's all about like, just basketball rather than the glitz and the glamour. And it's like they're ceding all of those things to the Lakers because they just kind of realized from a competitive advantage standpoint, they just can't keep up. I think it's actually really smart. And I wonder how much of that actually comes from Ballmer because of his business background. Like if you were just, taking over the Clippers as a small business and you were, just being, having brutally honest conversations, you would say, look, we're never going to top the Lakers. We could win 5 titles in a row. The Lakers still have 3 more decades of history of winning titles where, we're not going to be able to dislodge them. So like, how do we kind of paint ourselves in this marketplace? And I think it's, I give them a lot of credit just from a, kind of a strategy standpoint of the way they've done it. And I think that their new arena potentially fits right into that too, because I think that, being in Staples, not being the main tenant, it does kind of foster this like little brother mentality where some of the things that Lakers fans might say about them. And even at like the introductory press conference.
By the way, who's the little brother between you and Sharp?
I think technically I'm older. Yeah. What would you say? I mean, you've got twin sons. So you're an expert on this subject.
Well, you do have younger brothers. I feel like you try to little brother Sharp sometimes, but he's very good at defending himself and standing up to it.
Look, he's on vacation. I'm not going to pop any shots at him. I want him to come back eventually.
Yeah, when is he coming back? I was excited about texting him something the other day, and then you told me he's not going to respond to that. He's in wherever, yeah. Serbia or Croatia
or
somewhere.
Look, don't even get me started. Actually, you know what? I am going to pop some shots at him. I gave him explicit instructions that he goes on this, extended vacation to beautiful places to really step it up on Instagram. And you know what? His wife has been killing him on Instagram, Mike. Alice is just dropping all sorts of beautiful landscape photos, lots of great, portrait photos that could be, Andrew's like new Twitter avatar. I mean, some just really high quality gems.
Yeah.
I
haven't noticed him on Instagram.
Nothing. Like, yeah. I mean, it's a blackout. And I even called him out on it. I said, Andrew, you're getting killed by your wife on Instagram. You really need to step it up. And he's like, oh, man. He just was ready to take the loss. Just disappointed. I hate to blow up his spot and put his dirty laundry out there. But Andrew, the Instagram has not been nearly good enough.
Well, I think I texted him because I was doing a Thompson and Trudell reunion show with Michael Thompson, and we had you on. And Michael was very excited to talk about Legos with you. And I did not know this. Michael's somewhat of a brickhead. And this is really a connecting theme for you and Sharp. And it's become one for us because my sons were desperate to lay out all of their Legos for you when you came into the crib here.
No, it was great. So
Sharp didn't respond.
I come on to ESPN LA for the first time. I listened to Michael Thompson when I was a kid up in Portland radio. So this is like, fourth grade. I was listening to him and Kermit Washington just banter back and forth. I mean, they had a great radio show. This is like 90s, right? And the first question you throw me one about Kuzma. And then immediately it's just the hard pivot straight into Legos. And we're debating like, what does the Big Ben mean? All these different conversations. And ultimately, I think we did find some common ground because Clay, his son, is a chess player. And I think that, it's the same parts of your brain to play chess, to use Legos. I think that there's a lot of overlap there. And we kind of met on a good place. And Michael, yeah. I think people judge him from his Twitter account as being, almost like Bill Walton-esque sometimes, hard to relate to. But I think we brought it together and came to a firm understanding that all children, it should be really compulsory or mandatory that they should have Lego time. I mean, you force your kids to use Legos, what, 4 hours a day?
Life is about balance, okay? If we go outside and we play soccer and basketball and baseball for a half hour, then we come in and we try to work on our brain, and we have this coming together, and that's the way that we try to do it.
Yeah, no, it was great. I walked in the door, your beautiful house, and they immediately started firing Star Wars weapons at me, Star Wars Legos weapons. I was dodging. It kept me on my toes. It was a good summer workout. Just final thought here, Clippers, Lakers. Do you have any concerns about the Clippers on the court that maybe have been underplayed this summer?
Well, I think it's an enticing matchup, and I alluded to this earlier. What's the crunch time five going to be? And one of the things that was so good for the Clippers over the last couple of years was this Lou Williams and Montrezl Harrell screen roll off the bench. Well, if you have Paul George and Kawhi Leonard on the court, I don't know that you're running that a ton in crunch time. And so then is Lou Williams going to be on the floor as a spacer? But then you can go at him defensively, right? Is Harrell going to be on the floor as kind of a screen roll guy still? But then if you have Anthony Davis and LeBron, you can go to the rim, on Harrell. So that's on the other side, if you have George and Leonard, that's two guys that do about as well as anybody in guarding LeBron. And then what are they going to do with Davis? So it is fascinating to me to see how those teams line up. And I get it. The odds have fluctuated some in Vegas as to who's the favorite. I know it's the Clippers now, especially after Cousins got injured. It was the Lakers initially. How much of that is just money that comes in from Los Angeles to Vegas, right? That whole pipeline. So it's fascinating. But the secondary playmaker thing is interesting for me for the Lakers and what you were saying about Davis and what he's been working on. But does anything else stand out to you in the matchup? Yeah, well, I'll throw it back to you.
I think that for Montrezl Harrell, one of my favorite breakout guys last year, and he was in a complete honeymoon period, right? Because like he'd never really been on the map. The Clippers are having basically a dream season that not very many people saw coming. He was right in the mix for Sixth Man of the Year award and all that. Like the check comes due for him, right? Like he could also put himself into a situation where he makes a ton of money next summer once he hits free agency. But he's got to show that he can play, center against all-star level guys in late game situations. I think that they're going to have to use him that way. That's a big question mark. My other issue that I've seen is Kawhi Leonard going to miss a guy like Kyle Lowry? Because Kyle Lowry led a lot of the offense. He was a real playmaker. He didn't have the world's best regular season last year, but he did have very big responsibilities. To me, Paul George is not good enough as an initiator to take on that burden. You know, I think he's much better. Now he can be a number one guy, but he's not going to be your number one kind of like, you know, lead perimeter playmaker like a LeBron or a KD. I don't think your offense is going to be that great if he's in that role. And when you look at players like, you know, Pat Bev, I mean, Lou Williams is creating for himself primarily, or maybe a little bit of two-man game stuff, not running an entire offense. So are they in situations where the offense box down a little bit, where they're, you know, they struggle to get, you know, flow going, keeping the ball moving? Is there more of a burden just on Kawhi during the regular season than there was last year in Toronto from a minute standpoint, from a workload standpoint, from an initiation standpoint? And then, you know, is Paul George ready to like kind of hit the ground running once he gets back healthy, or is there going to be an ease up period? Because I think it's a lot of people just expect last year's Paul George to come back. And I think that that could wind up being the best year of his career. I mean, he was phenomenal. Every advanced stat, it was like top three, top five, right? And he had never been on that level as a player before.
Yeah.
So even if he has like, you know, just a solid A season instead of an A plus season, he's going to start to affect things as well. So to me, there's questions about the Clippers. I think I would still tend to side with the people I talk to in summer league, you know, around the league, whether it's execs, coaches, who kind of said they should be viewed as the early favorite. But I think, you know, it's, you know, as we've kind of discussed here, like there's not an overwhelming favorite in the Western Conference. There's arguments to be made for, you know, multiple different teams in terms of what they do. And, you know, the Lakers ultimately are going to be in the mix. And that was kind of one takeaway I had from the Cousins injury, by the way, is like, this wasn't a season breaker for them, right? Like, did you, when you saw that news, you weren't like, oh crap, this ruins everything?
Well, no, it was very unfortunate. I think you, like everybody, you first think about Cousins and then you think about the rotation. It did limit what I was kind of most excited to see with that just potential super big lineup, that talking about the Clippers, the Warriors, that how are they going to handle that when you have, if you had peak Cousins, or maybe peak is a little strong coming off of the injury, but at least a level above where he was in the finals. And he helped them win two finals games, like game two and game five, Cousins was really effective in. And then in the other games where he wasn't as effective, because I think part of this was just conditioning and coming back from the injury, that's when they were able to go small, and the Lakers could theoretically do the same thing. So that, maybe that peak upside stuff went away, but you're right. I don't think it lessened their chances too much to end up winning the whole thing, because it still does ultimately revolve around LeBron and Anthony Davis.
All right, guys, we went from ping pong to we had to land on Legos. There was 100% chance that Mike was going to bring up Legos at some point during this podcast.
We didn't even hit your Air Max preference over Jordans, which has been a thing recently.
Yeah, it's been a recent development this summer. We're also shared sneakerheads. Maybe we can invite you back to break down like the top five Jordans of all time at some point. But we got in. Ooh, really?
Yeah, threes are my favorite.
Oh,
now.
Come on. It's 11s.
No, I mean, look, 11s and 1s and 5s are in that mix too, but 3s are the most comfortable. I think look the best also. And 11s, while I love them, there's something about the patent leather that isn't always great in every situation.
Every situation.
In every situation.
Weddings, funerals, and everything in between.
But 3s, you can go anywhere, especially if you got the little elephant print on them.
Prom, did you wear Jordan 11s to prom?
No, I didn't have, like, I couldn't afford a bunch of Jordans, and I would get like one a year, you know, for basketball season, yeah. You know, and they get so dinked up, I couldn't be wearing those to prom.
Well, I'm not trying to say like I'm the richest man in the world, but I definitely wore some 11s to prom.
And I'm not trying to say I was poor, okay, and I couldn't afford any Jordans. I'm just saying it was one pair of sneakers a year, and now I have way too many pairs of sneakers.
All right, this is a conversation for a different podcast. Mike, yeah. Thanks so much time. Our listeners, the Open Floor Globe, can email us, openfloormail@gmail.com, openfloormail@gmail.com. They can also follow Mike on Twitter @LakersReporter. You can also follow us on Apple Podcasts by searching for Open Floor. That's two words. Find our page, scroll down. It will say rate and review. Tap 5 stars. It's just that easy. I'm on Instagram @Ben.Golliver. I've got some fire content coming up. Going on a couple of little trips here in the next couple of weeks. I don't want to spoil it.
Everyone, guess National Park.
Maybe if I'm lucky. Okay. In September for sure. This coming weekend, we'll see. Follow me on there. And be sure to email us. Like I said, come on, guys. Keep those emails coming. I need the help during this offseason. We're going to have another great episode coming for you next week with a familiar guest. You'll be glad to welcome him back. Openfloormail@gmail.com. Openfloormail@gmail.com. Until next week, I will talk to you.
Shout out, Glovers.